protesters out on the streets in northern Pakistan, angry, upset, frustrated at what they say was vote rigging.
Results of Pakistan's much-awaited general elections show candidates of former Prime Minister Imran Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party winning the largest number of seats in the National Assembly. This, despite the charismatic leader being in jail and a months-long military-backed crackdown against top leadership and supporters.
Some observers believe the biggest threat to Pakistan's democracy is the military, and critics claim the military has already decided who will win power this time.
2008 onwards, my belief is that the military shifted from control of state to control of governance. And as they have dug their heels into control of governance, their role or their aura has also changed. People will see them more critically part of all the problems that get created, not as an arbiter, which will provide relief.
Hi. You're listening to State of South Asia, a podcast from Himal South Asian, where we speak to some of the best minds on the region today to unpack crucial issues affecting our politics, cultures, environments, and societies. I'm your host, Nayantara. On the 4th of March, Shahbaz Sharif took oath as the Prime Minister of Pakistan after almost a month of political uncertainty in the country. The general election held on February 8th was largely seen as being unfree and unfair. The main actors in this election were the former Prime Minister Imran Khan and his Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party, and former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and his Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, or the PMLN. Having fallen out of favor with the military and ousted from office in 2022, Imran Khan had been charged with hundreds of cases and days before the election was convicted in four cases of corruption, with sentences of up to 14 years in prison. The military was meanwhile backing Nawaz Sharif, who had obtained clean chits in cases against him, and a court even lifted his previous disqualification from holding public office. However, February 8th and the results that emerged in the following days surprised everyone. The PTI, whose candidates had to contest as independents after it was barred from using its election symbol, made a much stronger showing than expected, winning the largest number of seats, followed by the PMLN and then the Pakistan People's Party, or the PPP. The PTI has, however, been unable to cobble together a coalition and has alleged extensive manipulation, giving it fewer seats than it says it has. Meanwhile, the PMLN and the PPP have come together to form the government, and the National Assembly chose Nawaz Sharif's brother, Shahbaz, to lead this government. In some ways, these elections followed an old script with allegations of the military dictating its terms. In some ways, it was surprising in how much support the underdog, in this case Imran Khan, got during the polls in the month after the election that was marked by protests, and even now. To discuss what this means for politics and for the military in Pakistan, we have with us today Aisha Siddiqa, Senior Fellow at the Department of War Studies at King's College in London, and author of Military Inc., a book that dives into Pakistan military's economic activities and its consequences. We're recording this conversation on March 5th, 2024. I am in Bangalore and I'm joined by Aisha, who is in London. Aisha, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure to be with Himal.
Aisha, what were your thoughts when you watched the election results come in February? How surprised were you by the PTI coming in with the most number of seats?
You know, it was of course surprising. Not that we didn't think that, you know, there was a sentiment in favor of the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. It was like, how would they kind of maneuver around the restrictions that were being imposed, you know, all the roadblocks that were being created on the election day for them, which would have made it difficult. One never thought that. So it came as a surprise that people had actually pushed back, but also as a, you know, in a very pleasant way as well, that within the South Asian region, the Pakistanis had set an example of actually standing up to all authoritarian restrictions and coming out and making their own choice we may agree or disagree with the choice. I would perhaps not go and vote for Imran Khan, but that's immaterial. The more important thing is that people thought this is what they wanted and they went ahead, you know, breaking down barriers and voting. You know, there were issues being created for them. Their polling agents were being picked up. There was a general harassment. And despite that, people came in and voted. So that part was a surprise. And one was immediately reminded of how, in some ways, people had voted in 1970 elections in Pakistan, where the military thought, you know, perhaps, I mean, their favorite was probably Jamaat-e-Islami then. But people went and voted Awami League in East Pakistan, what was then East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, and for the PPP in West Pakistan. Perhaps, and, you know, as we talk, we can, you know, talk a bit more about these election results and you know, what does this mean? But, and this could happen for several reasons. One, that, you know, people were adamant that this is how they're going to vote, but also perhaps within the system itself, you know, within the state bureaucracy, within the military itself, there were people who did not resist perhaps as much and were not as much on board with this project of keeping the PTI out of elections as we imagine. So, you know, the many thoughts on that.
Sure. You know, talking a little bit more about these roadblocks that you mentioned, the establishment really went after Imran Khan in the lead up to the elections with these many cases, at least 4 convictions. They took away the PTI's party symbol, which is a cricket bat. And so all the candidates had to contest as independents. On the day of the polls, there were reports of an internet shutdown, of suspension of cell phone services. You know, what were the signs that there were a kind of pre-poll fixing in trying to determine the outcome?
You know, what you've listed, you know, taking away, yeah, I mean, interesting things were happening. I mean, for example, the way people were divided across polling stations. I mean, in, for example, if there is 5 people in a household, 3 would be sent in a totally different direction, 2 in another direction, almost making sure that the turnout rate was low, that people would not make it. But here is a situation where people actually went and stood there for hours to vote. People, poor people, went from other cities, you know, in this time of economic crises, people still went out of their way to make sure that they voted. So that was a commitment to the underdog. Imran Khan is the underdog.
Right. You know, there is a saying in Pakistan, a joke that goes around that the military has never won a war and has never lost an election. But was this the first election that the military lost? Even if it has installed the government that it wants, finally, was this the first election that it lost?
No. As I mentioned, this is actually, that saying needs to be corrected. They've never won a war, but they've also never won an election, especially an election where people are more committed to kind of fight. 1970 elections, they couldn't interpret it correctly, people's sentiment. Again, this one, they thought that they would kind of manage, but they didn't manage. And this not being able to manage is because of people's resolve on one hand, but also perhaps, you know, gaps within their own institutional framework that, you know, people actually within their own institution let this happen. It's a question that I ask.
You know, talking about this new government that's just been formed and, you know, the ministers still have to be picked, but Shehbaz Sharif is going to lead this government. Pakistan is right now facing trouble on many fronts. There is, of course, the economic crisis, and the government already has plans to approach the IMF again. But it is facing impacts from environmental disasters. There is the unrest in Balochistan. How do you assess the strength of this coalition and the strength of this government? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, there is only one problem. That's the economic front. The rest are, you know, there they will be, you know, they'll come and go. This one is the most critical problem, is the economic problem. One is getting funding from the IMF. That's one issue. The other is kind of generating capacity in the country to start kind of reproducing more, attracting foreign direct investment, etc., and kind of pushing Pakistan up there as a country which can survive and deliver and be more normal. It's a daunting task, and for one, the problem is that the PPP, the Pakistan People's Party, which is part of the coalition, is part of the coalition yet not part of the coalition. The agreement under which they have rendered support to the Pakistan Muslim League is that, you know, Asif Ali Zardari of the PPP will become the president a second time, but they will not sit in the cabinet, and they will give support to the government on a issue-to-issue basis. Now, that basically means that military's intervention will increase, because every time you'll need some arm twisting, the government will approach the army and say, you know, talk to them, please, bring them to the table. That's one thing. And the other thing is that you have now a very fractious parliament. There's going to be so much of table thumping, you know, table banging. And you've seen the last 2-3 days of the parliament. And there are other roadblocks as well. So for the PTI, one of the things that PTI had to do, and why election symbol was important, was because now in the parliament, they have their, I think, their reserve seats for women and minorities. And those seats have to be kind of, those have to be selected by parties depending on their numbers. Now, if you don't have a symbol, if you're going as independents, independent members cannot select on these reserve seats. So you have to be a party. And therefore, the PTI joined the Sunni Ittehad Council, a religious party with just one member, one seat. Now, what the Election Commission, of course, and Election Commission has done correctly, that, you know, you had to submit your numbers before elections, right? Now, these guys have formed this coalition, internal coalition, have joined Sunni Ittehad Council after elections. So, but what is, you know, kind of much more questionable than this is that, you know, the Election Commission has said that we distribute these seats, which should have gone to PTI, to other parties. Now, that's clearly unfair. And this is clearly something which is being done to ensure that Asif Ali Zardari becomes the president. Because if their numbers swell, then it means that they'll have more seats in the parliament to vote against Asif Ali Zardari, because they've appointed Mahmood Khan Achaksai as their candidate for president. There's going to be, on every issue, there's going to be a tough fight. It's not going to be a smooth sail. And, you know, Bilawal Bhutto Zardari keeps saying that, you know, we have to reach out to each other. He keeps talking about appeasement. But, you know, nobody seems to be willing to go towards that appeasement.
Are there questions being raised in Pakistan about the military's hold over political proceedings?
Of course. The common man is very upset. And what has happened for the first time, I suppose, after 1970, is, see, 1970, there was a lot of questions being asked in what was then East Pakistan. West Pakistan always kind of was more dedicated to the army. Now, it's this Pakistan, the former West Pakistan, where questions are being asked. And we're not talking about Balochistan, where the army is not looked upon as a kind agent, or the tribal areas. It's mainland Pakistan, Punjab, soil of Sindh, you know, the Peshawar Valley. All these places are now questioning, people are questioning the military's role. You know, they're pointing a finger. I mean, recently in London, I met this Uber driver, Pakistani. So I asked him, I said, so who did your family vote for? He said, forget about my family. I flew from here to vote. So I said, so who did you vote for? And he said, Imran Khan. I said, all right, but he lost. And this guy says, now we have decided, me and my friends, that we'll boycott military and their families socially, right? So I'm not saying that, you know, that this is how this would work out and if it can work out. But the fact that this person is saying it, and he's so angry. So I asked him the question. I said, what if there is agreement between the army and Imran Khan and he comes back? What will you change then? And he said, no, this time we will not even support Imran Khan if he does that. We have understood that it's the military which kind of always creates hurdles for politicians, which manipulates and maneuvers. So there is a general anger. Pakistan, more than 50% of the vote bank is now between 18 to 35. You have this social media phenomenon. So there are a lot more things which are kind of informing people, right or wrong. I'm not saying they're educating them, but informing them, helping them make their minds one way or the other. And therefore, greater kind of unhappiness with the military's role.
So your sense is that there is a new general sense of disaffection with the military. But is it possible that the military will take action? Maybe a few heads at the top will roll. Maybe even the chief of army staff will kind of have to bear the blame. Someone new will come in. Would that change things? Would that again put them in a position to control politics and the government better?
No, I don't think that's about to happen. Firstly, there is unhappiness with the army. Perhaps the army is sensing it. But let me make it very clear that you're not about to see a million march against the military. It's not going to be Egypt-like situation. There's going to be unhappiness, and this unhappiness is going to grow, especially as economic challenges increase. Let's not forget that this government is about to go and negotiate a program with the IMF, which will mean more taxes, the increase in the cost of living, more unhappiness, which some of it will be directed towards the military. The military leadership right now is adamant that they are on the right track and that they cannot afford to. They're sitting on the horn of a dilemma. Either they let Imran return to politics and power, and he's going to be, let there be no doubt, he's going to be vengeful. He's going to be, who would like to put politicians in jail. And this is what has been Imran's kind of narrative for very long. And not reasonably talk to politicians, that's the fear. Or, earn the ire of people by keeping him out. So what the military is trying to do is going for the lesser. And so no heads will be rolling anytime soon, nor are they going to turn away. Things will continue. What they're definitely, the military is willing to do is perhaps kind of use a bit more force. They're happy to do that in mainland, pick up people, put restrictions and all of that. They're ready to do that.
Sure. So we're now going to be talking about the military's role in Pakistan's economy, the military's own finances. But a quick note before we go further. Himal's in-depth independent coverage of the whole of South Asia relies on the support of listeners like you. To support our work and help us produce more podcasts like this one, you can become a patron of the magazine by clicking on the link in the episode notes or by going to our website, www.himalmag.com, and clicking Support Himal. You can also sign up to our newsletters to keep up with our latest stories, podcasts, events, and more. You'll see a sign-up link to our newsletters also in the episode notes. Now, back to our conversation with Aisha Siddiqa. Aisha, in your book, Military Inc., you explain how the military is really not just in the business of war or defense, but in the business of business and has a hand in everything from agriculture to healthcare and from, you even say from bakeries to beauty parlors in some cases. And this is why it is essential for the military to have control over a civilian government, to maintain its financial autonomy and not to be dependent just on a defense budget that's allocated to it. Take us a little bit into how this MILBUS, as you call it, came about.
It started off in the 1960s with the first foundation, which is the Forgin Foundation. This was, which was set up with a war veterans fund, which was given by the British government divided between India and Pakistan. Pakistan used that money to set up industries because there wasn't an industrial base, and the military, which was more proactive, thought that would contribute towards that development. So the initial thought didn't start with autonomy, but with contributing towards development. Gradually, you know, it turned towards more greater greed of the echelons, you know, the whole thing about autonomy being autonomous. But, you know, my argument is also that it's not because they want to have more money. It's also about having more power. We are independent of the civilians. We don't depend on them. We can do it. We can do it better. So it's creating a tiny Lilliputian world of your own, which is what this Milbiz is about. And, you know, they compete, and they've been crowding out industries, civilian industries. So, you know, that continues to happen. But I think now what is Milbiz is one thing, which was a sideshow, because it never transformed the role of the military and took it away from external security, which was the main thing. So, you know, you'd ask the generals that you have this economic role, and they would, you know, frown and say, no, but this is not what we do. We do security. So, you know, the real soldier man, you know, would be protecting the nation rather than being considered a baker or a cement manufacturer or a fertilizer manufacturer, whatever. So they would frown about this idea of being looked at. I mean, they would always say, no, we're doing this for welfare of war veterans and soldiers and etc. Not trying to own up to the role which they were actually performing as well. But I think what has happened is much more critical, which is 2018, which is Imran Khan's government, brought in the military, the army chief, at the center of economic decision making. So the highest economic council, which was formed by the Imran Khan government, had army chief as a member. Fast forward, the PDM government, the coalition government, which took over after Imran was removed as a result of vote of no confidence in 2022, they create the Special Investment Facilitation Council, again, economic, which is meant to bring foreign direct investment into Pakistan, which is meant to retire public sector assets, sell, you know, Pakistan International Airline or Pakistan Steel Mill or other assets which are not money making, and bring in money into the country, period. And guess who's on the advisory? The army chief. Not just that. They also now have generals in sitting, lieutenant generals sitting on the operational side of this organization, the Special Investment Facilitation Council. So far deeper role in economic planning. And my argument, by the way, I'm kind of deviating, this is also one of the issues that will create greater resentment against the military. You know, military used to be this neutral arbiter, which would come and go every 10 years. You know, they would push out, they would impose martial law, you know, make some people happy. I mean, you remember 1999 when General Musharraf imposed his martial law. There were people who were dancing on the streets, who were distributing sweetmeat and happy. Now, no more, because 2008 onwards, my belief is that the military shifted from control of state to control of governance. And as they have dug their heels into control of governance, their role or their aura has also changed. People will see them more critically part of all the problems that get created, not as an arbiter, which will provide relief. And therefore, you know, in years to come, it will have an impact. The more they dig their heels and get entrenched in economic decision-making. But that is now a fact, that military is more involved in governance and in economic decision-making.
So is that also because people see that in that governance and economic decision-making, the military is acting in its own interests? You mentioned that the whole Milbiz phenomenon led to like an elite capture of resources. And when people start feeling that economic pinch, that they realize the military's role in it?
See, Milbiz is it is definitely an elite capture, but because they were monopolizing resources along with other civilian players, they're not creating monopolies. Monopolies were not created. They were monopolizing resources with other elite players. So the impact is not felt that much. Now, here is a situation where economic decision-making is going to touch on everyone's life. You know, recently, for example, they said that one of the decisions, and I'm not saying this is a military decision, this is a decision of whoever is sitting in the government and the SIFC, because there's this eagerness to sell PIA, Pakistan International Airlines, which has a huge debt burden. So the argument is, all right, in order to make it attractive for a buyer, for an international buyer, we will kind of shift its debt burden to public debt. So if I'm a taxpayer, I'm an ordinary Pakistani, this additional billions of rupees in taxes, which are going to be imposed on me, making my life more difficult. And therefore, people will be able to see it. They're coming into a big way into agriculture. So now they are become a contractor, like completely reminding one of, for example, the United Fruit Company of the United States, which operated in Latin and South America. Because they have an idea that they are going to take state land so far, but they're also they're making ground for corporate farming. Now, corporate farming was resisted. They're attracting farmers to the, you know, with smaller acreage that, you know, give us your land, we'll kind of cultivate, you know, whatever vegetables or something else, you know, and that will be sold outside to bring foreign exchange. And there are numerous issues related with it. And for example, because it's so export focused, then what about the needs of the people? Second, there is the issue of water, because as they kind of start growing and cultivating land, for example, in South Punjab, in the desert area, making it cultivable means diverting water. Now that there's already a water issue between Sindh and Punjab. This diversion will take water away from Sindh's quota problem. Also, within Punjab itself, when you divert water, you'll be diverting water from the share of existing farmers. There you have a problem. Second way of getting water is, turbines, tube wells, etc. It's going to further create ecological problems. Right now, I am from South Punjab. When I was growing up, you would find water at 10 to 15 feet. Now, you have to dig more than 100 feet to find water. Not just that, the amount of arsenic in the water has increased. So these are real climate, ecological issues, related issues, which, you know, the problem is that here is an institution, you know, they made their own company, Farmer Grow, I think, the 4G Foundation company, which has jumped into agriculture. The problem is civilian, you know, you can curse, you can abuse, you can fight, not with the military. There will be consequences. So that is going to add to tension. That's going to add to problems. And I think that's going to create problems with the military itself.
So when it comes to this bailout from the IMF, if I'm right, there have already been two tranches of money that's been given to Pakistan, and the government is going to approach the IMF for more. At some point, maybe some of this money is going to have to be returned. At some point, Pakistan has to start returning its debt. How does this happen? How does Pakistan find a way out of this without reducing military expenditure or rethinking the military's role in economic policy and governance?
You know, right now, nobody's thinking about reducing defense spending. That's definitely not a thought. You know, recently, the air chief announced that he's going to buy, you know, J-31 fighters from China. And one of the questions I raised was, where's the money going to come from? And of course, they say credit from China, which means increased debt. So they're not thinking. I mean, they're thinking that there will be investment. There will be investment from the Middle East into Pakistan. So, you know, perhaps be able to raise their profile from the current 6 to 7 billion to maybe 14 to 15 billion or more. You know, there is the Reko Diq copper mine. Pakistan is selling its share to Saudi Arabia. So perhaps 3 to 4 billion from there, US dollars, you know, agriculture, you know, corporate farming. They're trying to attract oil refinery, but these are all long-term projects. There are two issues here. One is that Pakistan is looking for immediate supply of resources. That's not coming easily. Secondly, long-term investment. And that's what makes politics and economics very cyclic. If there is instability in Pakistan, and if people watch and say, all right, this is an unstable country, we don't know who's going to be in government, maybe the next government has a different idea about investment, so why should we take a risk with Pakistan? So Pakistan's stability is essential. And what is happening, unfortunately, is that there is actually no arbiter in all of this. Political parties are all competing with each other. I mean, PTI is not willing to sit with the politicians. It's willing to sit with the military. You know, you have the PMLN and PPP with their own ideas. Nobody is thinking of finding a political solution for Balochistan. So use of force. So all of this is creating a long-term instability, which somehow needs to be, and there is no patching up of these differences. You know, in the 75 years, 76 years now, Pakistan has become much more difficult to manage. And the losing of an arbiter, an authority, you know, whom people could look toward is a great loss, I would say. And nobody has emerged as, you know, the alternative which would stand up.
Sure. Let's just talk a little more about Balochistan for a moment. Just before the elections, there was a huge protest, but the military's attitude towards Balochistan so far largely seems to have been denying, you know, the disappearances that people have said have been happening. What is the relationship right now between the military and people in Balochistan? And what, according to you, how should this be resolved?
See, there are two issues here. One is, you know, the long-term politics. We'll deal with this later. But the immediate issue is disappearances. You know, something has changed in Balochistan. And the change is that now you have women, young women, spearheading a campaign. They came to Islamabad. You know, they sat outside through the cold nights. They were, you know, the police threw dirty water on them to scare them, to, you know, all kind of coercive tactics, stood their ground. Why? They're saying, look, we have a constitutional right, you know, to justice. If you have our loved ones are responsible in anything, their courts, take them there, punish them. But don't, you know, kind of make them disappear. The mothers were saying, if you kill them, at least tell us so we can have closure. Right. So there is this movement, which is totally focused on disappearances. The government says, you know, the caretaker prime minister said, you know, there are only 50 people who've disappeared. See, how does one produce? I mean, it's a very, wherever disappearances happen around the world, it's a whole and a calibrated and a very callous and brutal government system, security system, which you have to face. And systematically to produce that evidence to say, this is where we thought, this is who picked up, you know, our loved one. Very difficult. This is one issue with Balochistan. There has to be a sense of accountability. The judiciary in Pakistan has to kind of stand up to that task. And perhaps them, you know, the judiciary, they may provide some relief here and there, but not an extended bigger role. So that's one issue. The other is political. What do you do with Balochistan? There's so much resentment amongst the Baloch that I've not come across, you know, any Baloch who would want to be, you know, who doesn't curse Punjabi army or wants to be part of Pakistan. Yet, I'm not suggesting that Balochistan is completely ripe for separatism, to separate from Pakistan. They are fighting. I mean, the capacity of Baloch separatists has enhanced, has multiplied. Of course, you know, there is aid from outside, not just one country, but several countries in the region. the capacity is enhanced, the kind of attacks. I mean, they would, 10 years ago, they would be attacking soft targets. Now they attack hard targets, military targets as well. So there is much more kind of resolve separate, yet we're not close to that where they would succeed in separate. And the issue then is how do you resolve Balochistan politically? How do you give relief? How do you give them sense of ownership? You know, for years and years, we sitting in Lahore, we sitting in Islamabad would happily use natural gas. You know, it was not until I traveled to India that I realized that, you know, here in Delhi, for example, you have gas cylinders. We would have natural gas supplied to our kitchen direct. So we would be, you know, in winters, we'd be warming our hands, not thinking for a minute where it came from, not even thinking, caring about the politics of the supply. Balochistan, Sui. Sui is the source in Balochistan of natural gas. It had a huge reserve now, which is drying very fast. But Balochistan, Sui was probably one of the last places to receive its own natural gas. The kind of underdevelopment that you have in Balochistan. And there is a Baloch middle class. And the one opportunity which, for example, Parvez Musharraf government lost, he did send a political delegation, you know, comprising of politicians to go and talk. And they did talk. They arrived at a formula, came back. The military government didn't apply it, right? And then, you know, they attacked, they killed Akbar Bukti, Nawab Akbar Bukti, a man who had always been pliant and willing to talk to the Pakistani state, yet killed him, which produced more anger. And that anger remains. My fear is that the state doesn't have the capacity to kind of negotiate. It only thinks in terms of force. I mean, you know, General Ziaulhaq today appears like Aristotle. He had better ideas. I mean, under him, he reached out to the separatists. He reached out to the Baloch nationalist leadership. And there was fairly more peace in Balochistan then than what you have now. I think part of the issue is that the civil military leadership tends to look at Balochistan mainly as a security issue, not as a political issue. The PPP, which has been allowed to form a government, has brought in Sarfaraz Bukti, who was a militant, who has killed people. He's now the chief minister, and he's going to use force. There's going to be more disappearances, not less.
Sure. So just, you know, coming back to the IMF crisis, and at this point where people are angry with the military, kind of holding them to account for what has happened in Pakistan. In the past, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in the past, there's always been a war when the Pakistan military needed one to kind of bolster its image and have people rely on it. Or some geopolitical circumstances has come to the military's aid. But now there doesn't seem to be anything like that. So what does the military do now?
It happened both ways, you know. Neighboring India also creates wars, or neighboring Pakistan creates wars too. The governments need wars. But, you know, one of the interesting developments that has taken place is that the militaries in the region, definitely Pakistan military, sees that it does not want a war. It wants Kashmir resolved, but more politically rather than militarily. The military options dried up, primarily because of the Financial Action Task Force putting restrictions in Pakistan, made earlier policy of using militancy less tenable. Not saying that that option is entirely shut, but cannot have, you know, what was there 20 years ago, what was there in the 1990s through the 2000s. I mean, that scene, they can raise the temperature every now and then. Sure, that capacity is there, but not, you know, the kind which would lead to then conflict. Not the intention to do perhaps another Mumbai or a Kargil. So that is out of question. In fact, what is good between India and Pakistan is that the LOC has largely remained peaceful, you know, which is good. Even if you don't talk, at least there is that peace. There is no war happening. But, you know, the disputes remain. As long as those disputes are there, the military can keep justifying its presence. And right now, what the army chief feels and believes is that, you know, there is a need for economic recovery. And that's where his attention is focused, not fighting another war with anyone. This does not necessarily indicate military weakening, but this, you know, indicates that both the military and civilian government are thinking about other things. Other issues are, economy is more important.
Does the new government or the new political arrangement change anything in relations with Pakistan's other neighbors, with Afghanistan, with China? Is there any change that you see coming there?
Nothing dramatic. I mean, the one thing which the government, this government would want to, is eager to do, is actually improve relations with the United States. I think right now there's nothing dramatic which is going to happen. I mean, not United States is not going to open floodgates. You know, there is a program which is aiding Pakistan's agricultural initiative. So there's a small program which has been there. You know, Pakistan is looking for American investors to come. So, you know, all of these are ongoing discussions. Nothing major. What is also important is that United States understands that Pakistan is not going to break away from China. It needn't break away from China, but keep a balance. So with China, what is not going to change definitely is that relations will remain there. Let's not forget that almost 80% of our military hardware is now Chinese. Not really out of choice, because the West will not supply to Pakistan. And Pakistan doesn't have deep pockets to buy Western goods. So China is the option. But Pakistan-China is a longer frame.
Sure. I should just have a final question. You know, I want to come back to, you know, who the main actors were initially, and that's Nawaz Sharif and Imran Khan. Nawaz Sharif, of course, is taking a back seat. He is not part of this government officially. What is his political future? And Imran Khan, of course, continues to be incarcerated. He will have to fight all these cases and charges against him. But what is his role in, you know, shaping Pakistan's political future?
Imran Khan, for at least now, is going to be in jail. Will remain in jail. He's lucky, of course, because he is a Punjabi politician, and so will not be treated, hung, or, you know, killed like Bhutto was, you know, in 1979. Despite that, you know, the army chief is very angry with Imran Khan. You know, it's a matter of diverse opposing calculations. The military would like to talk to him, but he appears more confident. What the army has also miscalculated is that they're not dealing with any ordinary politician. They're dealing with a populist. A populist is a different breed. My argument is that a populist can be killed politically only by the populist himself. Bring him back to power. See, if he doesn't perform, people will vote him out. I mean, had they allowed him to continue, honestly, in 2022, he would have been finished politically, because his economic performance wasn't great. And at that time, when the vote of no confidence happened, people were getting tired. I mean, his own electables in his party were looking around for which party should I join. You know, PTI ticket, you know, the hot item wasn't selling like hotcakes then. Vote of no confidence, the IMF deal, Ukraine war, fuel prices going up. There were a lot of things which happened all of a sudden, which made, you know, the life of the coalition government more difficult. So going back, you know, either you let him kind of come back to power, take out his anger. But, you know, here, that's where the issue is. They're afraid of his U-turns. You know, if he comes to power with this confidence, he's going to, you know, the PMLN is afraid he's going to put them in jail. You know, there'll be those cases brought back. You know, what will he do with the military leadership? How vengeful will he be? Right now, Imran Khan does not want a conversation with the political parties. He wants only to talk to the military. The military, the army chief, is not interested in him. He wants, perhaps, he's looking more at his extension in the next 18 months when his tenure ends. So there are these issues which would keep him in jail for the moment. Unless, you know, there is this million march outside which makes a case for him. I mean, right now what we see is that there is a lot of uncomfortable environment in the parliament. Yet, you know, they went to court. They want to be part of the process. Ultimately, you know, Imran does get relief. And that relief would be, you know, perhaps they shift him from jail to his house in Banigala. Islamabad, you know, make that into a sub jail. At least he's at home and with restrictions. But if nothing changes, the next 18 months for sure, he's inside. He'll be in jail. What 18 months teach us? How politics pans out? Does the PTI strengthen? Does the PTI weaken? You know, there are a lot of issues. It's become a much more complex picture. It's interesting, you know, going back to military and the populace. Bhutto was one populist who decided to hung, you know, there was a judicial trial or a mistrial, and he was hanged in 79. After that, the generation with the army produced was the Sharifs of the PMLN, who were much more pliant. I mean, they were businessmen. They would, every time there was a push, they would agree to leave the country. They left the country in 2000s after Musharraf's martial law. Then they left again. Nawaz Sharif left for the UK when Bajwa, General Bajwa, was pushing him, remained here for 4 years and then came back. So the military was certainly not used to, you know, a leader who would say, all right, I'm in jail, I'll stay in jail. Keep me in jail. You know, now the thing is that he turns out to be an underdog. And this is what people in South Asia love to see. They like, you know, it generates sympathy, it generates definitely more sympathy, which is not good for the military's purpose. The question is, how will they kind of start talking to him? At what point? I mean, I'm not saying that they're not renegotiating right now, but these negotiations are not reaching anywhere, any conclusion. And he's agreeing to kind of sit back and not push forward.
Right. And what about Nawaz Sharif's political future?
I think this is the end of Nawaz Sharif as a prime minister. I mean, he came thinking he's going to be a four-time prime minister. That's not going to happen. His daughter is now the chief minister in Punjab, which is almost an entire country. You know, so he's got that part of power. Punjab, where majority of the military also comes from, bureaucracy comes from. So it's a very important province. And running that is almost as good as running Pakistan. So he wants to, you know, handhold his daughter to run that. And of course, there is his brother and PMLN government in the center. So he will sit on the sidelines. He's Pakistan's Sonia Gandhi for the moment. He's also getting old, right? So he'll probably has more of an advisory role. It is a firmer advisory role, you know, like again, Sonia Gandhi. He gets to decide. So now we know that the federal cabinet and the Punjab cabinet, the names will be selected by him. He's the man. They'll also have to, whoever talks to the civilian government will have to talk to him as well. He'll be sitting on the table. That's the role which Nawaz will have, but not as a prime minister.
Right. Well, Aisha, that's been one great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. That was political and military analyst Aisha Siddiqa speaking to Himal South Asian for the State of South Asia podcast. This podcast was edited by Ritika Chauhan. You can find many more stories on the politics of Pakistan on our website, www.himalmag.com. You can also read reportage and analysis from across South Asia, listen to our other podcasts, and sign up for our newsletters to keep up with Himal's work. We'll be back in 4 weeks with another in-depth conversation on the next episode of State of South Asia. Thank you for listening, and see you then.